A single story from the Bible can speak to us in different ways depending on the thoughts and attitudes we bring to the story. I delivered a sermon on today's Bible passage about 3.5 years ago, and that sermon bears no resemblance to the message you'll hear this morning, which is called Launch Out into the Deep 2. This story is set in the earliest stages of the ministry of Jesus before he'd called a single disciple. The local Galilean fishermen, after a long and unsuccessful day of fishing in the Sea of Galilee, have rowed ashore and are washing their empty fishing nets. A crowd has followed Jesus to the western shore of that sea, many having been lured by his preaching, others drawn by rumors of his ability to heal the sick. Jesus asks Simon, who will soon be renamed Peter, to row him out away from the shore, where he can preach to the crowd from a safe distance. Afterwards, Jesus tells Simon, "Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And you know the rest of this story. The skeptical fishermen do as Jesus says, and their nets are filled to overflowing with fish. Another boat rushes from the shore, filling its nets as well. Simon and his partners, lifelong fishermen by trade, know they are experiencing something that cannot be explained. And Simon falls to his knees in fear. But Jesus assures him he need not be afraid and tells him that now, instead of being a fisherman for fish, he will be a fisherman for people. The story ends by saying, when they had brought their boats to the shore, they left everything and followed him. Like most good stories, this one operates on more than one level. It can be viewed as a simple story about a guy who really knew how to fish. Or it can be thought of as a miracle story, and it is most often referred to as the miraculous catch of fish. And then there is that deeper level, fitting for a story about the deep. To get straight to the point, Jesus finds people hanging around in the shallows, frustrated with the way things have been going. Jesus directs them to the deep, where they are suddenly awestruck at the possibilities that are right in front of them if only they leave the shallows and launch out into the deep. It doesn't take a metaphorical genius to see how this story can reach across the ages and apply to our lives today. In fact, perhaps this story is more relevant now than it has ever been. You've heard me mention my favorite philosopher, or at least my favorite living philosopher, Ken Wilber. One of his favorite themes is flatland. Flatland, he says, is the nature of the modern world. Wilber says we have become so obsessed with facts, and especially with the science of explaining how the material world operates, we've lost the depth dimension to our lives. Life in the modern world tends to have no meaning because we spend all of our time on the surface in flatland and seldom plumb into our spiritual depths to seek the whys behind the whats, the meanings behind the facts. By the way, Ken Wilber is not against science. In fact, he is an excellent scientist, and he studies all science voraciously. He simply thinks we need to find ways to integrate our spirituality with science in order that we may live more abundant, fulfilling, and meaningful lives. Before we look at ways we could live deeper lives, ways to honestly search for greater depth in lives that, let's face it, are more easily lived in the shallows, I want to mention one other philosopher who, I believe, got straight to the point without devising any cumbersome philosophical systems. Some people run when they see the name Martin Heidegger because he was an existentialist. And the very word existentialism tends to make people assume they're going to have to think thoughts that should be reserved for the great philosophers. And that's nonsense. Existentialism is a big word for a simple idea, and that idea is this. People should not look outside of themselves to find meaning for their lives. People create meaning when they take responsibility for their lives. and the things we do, the way we live, the way we choose to exist in the world, define who we are. That is existentialism. And whether a person wants to adhere to that philosophy or not, it's just not that difficult an idea. It's not, by the way, bound to any particular religious belief. The existentialist label has been applied to Soren Kierkegaard, a devout Christian, to Martin Buber, a devout Jew, as well as many committed atheists, such as Jean-Paul Sartre. What they share is the belief that meaning comes from within in the living of our lives. Now, Martin Heidegger's great insight was this. Human beings have a sense of having been thrown into the world. We all have this sense of thrownness. None of us asked to live, but here we are. And now that we're here and alive, we'd like to remain here permanently, but we won't. We have this sense of having been thrown into the world, blindly tossed into a game we never asked to play, and furthermore, the rules aren't even clear. And, Heidegger goes on, this sense of thrownness leads to anxiety. A human being can never completely relax. There's always something gnawing at us. We can never get entirely comfortable because there's always this little voice somewhere deep inside saying, something's amiss, something's not quite right. And that something is the fact that the very nature of human life involves not being ultimately in control, or that sense of thrownness. In response to life, and in particular, in response to the anxiety that is a part of human life, Heidegger says that each and every one of us must choose one of two paths. We can call these paths the false path and the authentic path. The overwhelming majority of people take the false path. On this path, people just don't think about the fact that they've been thrown into this world. They ignore it. In fact, they choose not to think about life any more than is absolutely necessary. And they ward off anxiety by keeping themselves absorbed in shallow, mundane concerns. In other words, they try to stay so busy they never have to think about the fact they're alive. According to Heidegger, that is exactly how almost everybody goes through life. And then there's the authentic path. On this path, a person directly confronts his or her thrownness and the anxiety caused by that condition. And then one makes this commitment. I acknowledge that I am not responsible for my being here in the first place, but I accept full responsibility for my life and for my actions, and I embrace life. I promise myself to live life fully. This person, according to Heidegger, then lives an authentic life. And the rare person who commits to an authentic life grows to love life itself, to absolutely cherish the fact that he or she is alive. Well, enough of Heidegger. It can be scary launching out into the deep. And when I look back over the great thinkers of past and present, it occurs to me that many philosophers have been tragically unhappy people. In most cases, it is that innate sense of spirituality that determines whether one's philosophical journey will be a joyous pilgrimage through heaven or a desperate trek through hell. It is a simple trust in the underlying goodness of the universe that separates the wondrous awe of an Immanuel Kant from the brutal hell of a Friedrich Nietzsche. And I remind you, when Jesus tells the disciples to launch out into the deep, they take Jesus with them. I would advise the same. Well, what would it mean for you and me, living on the forward edge of the 21st century, to launch out into the deep? And is there any reason to do such a thing? Who says that life in early 21st century America is less than authentic? Well, for this discussion, we have to approach these questions as the church. I mean, when we ask if life in 21st century America is authentic, we might get a different answer from the Chamber of Commerce or the president of an advertising agency than we would from the church. And that's not an attack on anybody. I have friends in advertising. I was in marketing for many years. All I'm saying is that we have to know who's asking the question before we can weigh the value of the answer. And in this case, I want the church to ask that question. Is life in early 21st century America authentic? Or are we, for the most part, on the false path Heidegger warned us about? To put it in terms more familiar to the church, are we, after 2,000 years, still ignoring the advice of Jesus to launch out into the deep? There's an ongoing debate in Christianity regarding how the church should be involved with the world. On one extreme are those who believe the church should always stand over against the world. This faction holds that if the church gets mixed up in the everyday happenings of society, it ceases to be able to function as the conscience of that society. And on the other extreme are those for whom the church is very much a part of society, so much you can't tell where everyday life ends and the church begins. Most of us try to seek a balance between these two extreme views. As for those who believe the church has no place whatsoever getting mixed up with society, well, I have a real problem with that. As much as I am a believer in private prayer, meditation, and time alone for contemplation, if all Christians completely distance themselves from the world and hide away on their own private mountaintops, fervently praying to remain pristine and pure, then the church becomes inconsequential. On the other hand, we have seen time and again what happens when the church fails to differentiate itself from the everyday world. The church winds up becoming a tool of the oppressive forces it is intended to stand against. It happened in the Middle Ages when much of the world was ruled by the church. It happened during the Spanish Inquisition. And in pre-World War II Germany, the church was so inseparable from the rest of society, Christianity in Germany became a tool of Nazi propaganda and never even knew it was happening. Just as a side note, I'm in a real minority here, but I fear the wide support I see for federal funding of faith-based organizations, which is a euphemism for churches. It sounds like such a great idea on the surface, and it has Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal support. But accountability for the way federal money is spent is essential, and when the church reports to the government in order to justify continued funding, it becomes the social welfare arm of the state. The wall of separation disappears. Think of this. I cannot find a single example in the 2,000-year history of the church when the church and state have worked together and the result has ended up being anything other than disastrous. The church needs to be protected from the state. And just as much, the state needs to be protected from the church. To construct bridges over the wall our founders built between church and state is to tinker with something that I think is better left alone. Moving beyond my passionate belief in the separation of church and state and back to the topic of this morning's sermon, let's consider the question posed by the church: is life in America today authentic? I thought about this a great deal over the weeks this sermon was coming together, and I recognize that I'm very much a product of my environment. I'm not at all uncomfortable in early 21st century America, so I'm in no position to throw stones at anybody or anything here. But the more I thought about this, the more I came to the realization that there really is a certain emptiness that underlies the modern world. And instead of helping us fill that emptiness, popular culture tends to prey on that emptiness, convincing us we will be filled only if we give in to whatever it is we're being sold. That sounds a little cynical, not to mention a little abstract, so let's take a few concrete examples. Has anybody ever had as much fun as the people in those beer and wine commercials? Really, have I just been unlucky all my life? And I've had my share of fun, but there's clearly something wrong with me because I have never been at a party where everybody is just glowing with warmth and love and at the same time enjoying a good heartfelt laugh together, and where everybody present is genuine and witty and incredibly good looking. And I know why. I drink the wrong kind of wine. All I have to do is change to Gossamer Bay Mountain Chablis, and every woman at my party will look like a member of the Swedish bikini team. That is, if I trade cars. Don't you love the commercial? I hope you've seen this, where the guy leaves the restaurant with his date, and she walks up to the nice new car, waiting for him to open the door. And he's standing behind that car at his old clunker with this embarrassed look on his face. And the advertiser's message is clear. This guy just had his first and last date with this beautiful young woman. And that's the way it should be, because nobody deserves a good date unless he buys one of our cars. Of course, there is a hidden message in that commercial that I think is quite insulting to women. Namely, that women are superficial and predatory when it comes to wealth. But hey, they're not the target market, so no harm done. As for the shows on television, I'll just mention a few with the lessons they teach us. Survivor. Lesson: nice guys finish last. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Greed, etc. Lesson: money is the root of all happiness. Temptation Island, lesson: lust conquers all. And the problem is not with television alone. Whether you turn on the television, go to the movies, or read a magazine, you're going to get one message loud and clear. Recreational sex is the national pastime. And let's not get all mushy here by letting love sneak into this picture. What we are talking about is the equivalent of an Olympic sport. But ladies, if you'll buy the right clothes, use the right makeup, and join the right health club, and guys, if you'll buy the right car, drink the right booze, and take the right vitamin supplements, then you too can be a viable competitor. And all this junk we're bombarded with every day has an effect on us and on our children, because there is something inside of us that keeps gnawing at us, a sense of emptiness, a sense of not being quite in complete control, of never quite attaining that state of real happiness. So what do? We do exactly what Martin Heidegger said we would do. We try to ignore that emptiness by staying so busy we don't think about it. Because if we have those types of feelings, it must be because there's something wrong with us. We're either not drinking the right wine or not driving the right car or living in a house that would be an embarrassment to a truly successful person. But the fact is, the only thing wrong with us is we're trying to fill our emptiness with all the wrong things. And the irony is that when we attempt to fill that emptiness with the trimmings of popular culture, it doesn't work. The emptiness is still there. We can try for the length of our lives to fill that emptiness with wine and cars and recreational sex, and it is not going away. There is only one thing that can fill that emptiness, and that is love. And I believe that is exactly what is waiting for us in the deep. Love. That's why Jesus said to go there. If you remember the story, once the disciples get to the deep, their once empty nets are suddenly overflowing. Hey, they didn't really want to go there in the first place, and when they got there, they were terrified. But after they had made the journey, their lives were changed forever. I don't know, maybe it was easier launching out into the deep 2,000 years ago. We are bombarded with messages every day created to keep us right where we are. We have an awful lot of trivial junk to wade through if we're going to make it out of the shallows. But I believe the trip is worth it, because I believe that if we can push through all the barriers that have been erected to keep us out of the deep, we will find within us a love that transcends every attempt that has ever been made to describe it. It is the very power of God that calls us into being. I hope you'll think about that, because it's the core of my theology. If you and I go to the very center of who and what we are, we will find God. God is waiting for us in there. And once we surrender ourselves to that love of God within us, we soon find that we can't help but respond to the world around us with real love. I leave you with the words of Fyodor Dostoevsky, who described that response to God's love better than I ever could. Love all of God's creation, the whole and every grain of sand in it. Love every leaf. Love every ray of God's light. Love the animals. Love the plants. Love everything. If you love everything, you will perceive the divine mystery in things. And once you perceive it, you will begin to comprehend it better every day, and you will come at last to love the world with an all-embracing love. Amen.